By the way, I'm fighting off a cold, so I hope I don't get you guys sick.
You know what? That's actually kind of... Can we cancel this? Cause I don't want to get sick right now, dude.
I don't want to give you a virus.
Well, do you mean computer or otherwise?
I think Alexis got me sick because she had like a nasal drip or something in the last
one. Yeah, and then she died, so you're next.
Oh no.
Okay.
My name's Joe. I'm going to be one of the co-hosts today on another exciting episode of the first podcast. And with me, I have two other special individuals, one of which is Lars, our regular host. And also, we have... Take it away.
Oh, Alexandria Brown.
Yes.
So I'm a 30-year-old author who recently completed a memoir about my role and exposing criminal allegations against one of the organizers of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. I'm from Florida. I started studying philosophy at the college level when I was 13. I'm a painter, I'm a filmmaker. Yeah, I guess you guys know I'm pretty far left with some libertarian leanings. I used to be a dominatrix, but I'm not really sure what I'm doing for money these days because like all my time goes into promoting this book.
What's the book called, by the way?
It's called The Noble Person Does Not Sin, A Tragedy in Three Parts.
And just briefly, like, what are those three parts? What's kind of just a summary of what it goes over?
So it basically goes over the entirety of my friendship with Augustus Sol Invictus. That is Latin for majestic, unconquered sun, by the way.
He changed his name to that, didn't he?
It was bestowed upon him in a pagan ritual. He was like a Thelemite.
Yeah, it's kind of dorky, but oh well.
It's super dorky.
And then he legally changed his name?
Yeah, he legally changed his name to this like witchcraft name that they gave him.
It's kind of like if I changed my name to like the fighting warrior extraordinaire.
Yeah, it's like a little bit too grand. Yeah, like Cooley McStabby in the face. Like, yeah, I don't know. It's just
naming yourself.
People don't really
Alexander
do that outside of video
great.
Games.
We can just get all the funny stuff about him out there right from the get-go. He also ritually sacrificed a goat in a pagan ritual when he had just completed a pilgrimage across the United States.
Why?
He sent out a mass email calling for civil war that got the FBI after him.
Sounds like a great dude.
Yeah.
Going back to the goat thing, I've always wanted to road trip across the United States, and in fact, I am moving to Florida sometime next year, and we're driving, so I'm going to do that, but we won't be sacrificing any goats.
No. No,
maybe like a chicken, but...
He sounds kind of like Foghorn Leghorn in speeches. Like, it's kind of a mix between this, like, Southern accent and, like, John F. Kennedy. Yeah, there's, like, a metal band that sampled one of his speeches once. It's, like, one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life.
I looked at a picture of him, and he looks like someone who takes himself very seriously.
Yeah. Like, he thinks he's a god. He's had mystical visions, and he told me about, like, a trip to Mexico he took where, like, I don't know, Mercury was in retrograde or something, and, like, his whole fate to, like, overthrow the existing order of the federal government was revealed to him, and, you know, he had to lead a war.
And as you know, he obviously succeeded in that. I mean, what is he talking about? I don't...
It's funny, but it's also kind of scary, because, like, there's, 30 pages of police reports about him, like, threatening people with a gun, threatening to kill people. And as I talk about in my book, there's an allegation that he spent 15 months beating this 19-year-old girl that he was engaged to pretty violently. Like, she can't hear out of one of her ears anymore.
Oh, my God.
And he would strangle her to the point of unconsciousness. And, well, this is what she told me. Legally speaking, I didn't witness it, so I have to specify that. But they were extremely detailed allegations that were told to me directly by her. And she's 19, and she's not even a leftist. Like, I, you know, she has no agenda against him. So I don't know really why she would be lying. And he also, she said that he was going to, he threatened to kill her if she ever spoke out about the allegations. So, like, when she came to me, I had to explain to her that actually speaking out was what would make her safer, because, like, then everyone would know if something happened to her, who had done it.
So she didn't want to originally speak out. Is that what you were saying?
She was pretty scared about it.
Scared of him?
Yeah. Like, and his white network of white supremacists. Yeah. He represented a white, he's a criminal defense attorney, and he represented a white supremacist terrorist organization called American Front in court when they were accused of, like, illegal, like, paramilitary training and stockpiling weapons and or something. And, so he's got a lot of connections to pretty violent people. And that was why she was, you know, in the relationship for 15 months before she said anything.
So how did you run across this person?
So it's a sort of a two-pronged story how I ran across him. Because there's, like, a normal reason and then there's a totally insane reason. There's a normal reason that I met him, but the reason I became friends with him is a little weirder.
Go for it.
So I was in a graduate seminar on Friedrich Nietzsche, and the assignment that we sort of had was to construct interpretations of Nietzsche that are resistant to the historical appropriation of his rhetoric by the Third Reich. So, hold on, I lost my train of thought.
By the way, the fireworks from Disneyland are going off right now, and I live a mile away, so you will possibly be able to hear them.
We can layer them over your most triumphant moment in the episode.
Yeah. I'm close to Disney World, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's where I'm moving to, Orlando.
Yeah, that's where Augustus cool. lived before he fled the state. but so I knew of him because, like, when he was a former candidate, I should have mentioned this sooner, he's a former candidate for U.S. Senator with the Libertarian Party in Florida. And his campaign was going on at the time, and he had people who were freaking out about him in the Libertarian Party. One person named Adrian Wiley actually resigned from the party in protest of his candidacy, and they exposed the goat sacrifice story. So that was, like, even on, like, BBC News, like, Florida man sacrifices.
Oh, Florida man.
And runs for office.
That sounds just about right for Florida man.
Right.
That's a common one, yeah.
That should be his superhero name. Florida man.
Yeah. Just a representation of everything that's wrong with the Florida man in every news article.
Yeah, this whole story is very Florida. But anyway, I had added him on Facebook sort of as a joke after I read news stories about him. Because, you know, his speeches are all on YouTube and they're crazy speeches. Like, it's kind of like all of the worst stuff about Nietzsche's writing style in terms of how, like, over the top and megalomaniacal everything is. but so I knew that I didn't know that he was a fascist at the time because he said he was a libertarian, but I knew that he associated with fascists. Like, I knew that he had represented American Front in court. And since, like, I was interested in not just distinguishing Nietzsche from the rhetoric that fascists in Nazi Germany were using, but actually distinguishing Nietzsche's rhetoric from the rhetoric that contemporary fascists were using, I wanted to, like, find somebody who knew about contemporary fascism. So I decided to interview him on that basis. But the problem is that I also, I have bipolar, and I was taking a medication at the time for that, which, like, has this side effect if you stop it abruptly where you become psychotic. So I had, like, an insurance problem and I couldn't get this medication. So right after I interviewed him, I lost access to the medication and became psychotic. And then, like, I started to believe in his mystical visions, too. And I thought that he was, like, I thought that the Holocaust was recurring and that he was the one who was going to save us from it. And so he, like, came over. He came over and he, like, looked at all my paintings. And this was the first time we had met in person because the interview was over Skype. And I was just, like, sitting there, like, out of it, staring into space, and I wouldn't talk to him. So he came to hang out and he stayed for about 5 minutes and realized, like, I wasn't talking, and he left. But, like, in the meantime, in my mind, like, this was a meeting that was changing world history. And, like, he was going to start a great war after he left my room. So It was, like, really, and it took a couple of weeks for me to get out of that. And by the time I got out of it, we were sort of, like, on friendly terms already. So we just kind of kept hanging out in this way that was, like, it was just kind of an anomaly in my life because I'm not really close to anyone who's even, like, conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, like, I don't know. He's very charismatic, despite how crazy he is, like, from a distance in the media. So I guess, like, maybe I just fell for that.
It's common, yeah. Sometimes some of the worst people in history have been extremely charismatic.
Yeah, I guess there's the whole thing, like, that sociopaths are extremely charming.
In doing just some brief research, I found a quote by him. "Do I believe that 6 million Jews were killed by evil Hitler? Is that what you're asking me?" he said. And then his response was, "Okay, then I'm still waiting to see those facts."
Yeah.
So he's a Holocaust denier.
Right. So I actually was, as far as I know, I was the first person who got him to admit to Holocaust denialism. So, like, throughout the time that I was close to him, a lot of my friends started saying, "Something's wrong. We think he might be a Nazi. You know, you shouldn't talk to him." Mm-hmm. And I was kind of in denial about it. And eventually my conscience kind of caught up with me. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do another interview with him that's, like, all about fascism. Like, not about Nietzsche, not about his campaign.
What was the goal for that interview?
I wanted to figure out if he was a fascist. And So in that interview, he does admit to Holocaust denialism. And he says he agrees with 99% of what Carl Schmitt says. Carl Schmitt's a Nazi legal theorist. So, and then he said this was the most accurate and comprehensive interview anyone had ever done with him. So I'm assuming that those things are all true. And yeah, so I didn't see him again after that.
So you chose to cut ties at that point once you realized what his actual character was like.
Yeah, he was still on my Facebook, but I didn't see him again after that.
Okay.
So how long had you known him by that point?
So I met him around, I can never remember. It was either March or June of 2016. And that was January 2017 that I did the second interview.
So how did you go from that to wanting to write a book about him?
So after the allegations became public and his ex, whose name is Victoria, by the way, it's out in the media already, so I am comfortable using her name. She reported it to the police, and at the same time, even though she was the one reporting it, because she's 19 and he knew she was pretty much, like, brainwashed to do whatever he said through the course of their relationship out of fear, he knew that, like, someone else had intervened. And so he found out that I had encouraged her to go to the police, and I had also publicized the allegations to a lot of media outlets. I tipped off the SPLC and a bunch of other websites covered articles about it. So he, like, retaliated against me. He both threatened a defamation lawsuit against me, which I got out of by issuing a statement saying I didn't witness any violence firsthand, despite having no reason to believe she was lying. And then he also kind of went lower, and I'm a sex worker, like I mentioned, I'm a dominatrix, and he published my, like, dominatrix name on neo-Nazi blogs. And So I started getting, like, stalked by a bunch of fascists who would call my phone sex line and say, like, threatening and obscene, really obscene, like, racist things too. But they'd also, like, threaten to come find me and kill me and stuff. So that was all. And in the meantime, like, a bunch of my friends had decided that, like, I couldn't possibly not have known that he was a fascist. And a lot of my friends thought that I was a Nazi sympathizer and cut ties with me. So I was, like, isolated, and I was getting harassed by neo-Nazis. So I kind of started to, like, lose it. And I reached out to Antifa, specifically Great Lakes Antifa. And I started talking to Daryl Lamont Jenkins, who does the One People's Project. And Daryl Lamont Jenkins suggested that I just write an essay for his site, Idavox. So an essay was published up there for a while, and it ultimately turned into the memoir. And writing it was really helpful in allowing me to kind of move on from everything.
Do you feel like people perceive you differently now that they've read your book?
I don't know if there's anyone who, like, thought I was a Nazi sympathizer and then read the book and decided I wasn't, if that's what you mean. But
yeah,
I don't know. Nobody's come to me and told me that. But mm-hmm. I guess it's possible. I wasn't even necessarily trying to prove that with the book. I don't mm-hmm. really do a good job of that in the book, if that's my goal, because I'm really honest in the book about, like, the affection that I developed for him over the course of the relationship.
What was your goal?
My goal was to just further publicize the allegations, and B, like I said, to allow myself to move on from the relationship, because I was pretty, like, obsessed with what happened and the fact that no charges were ever pursued against him and all of that. Because I'm a domestic violence survivor myself, and I have mm-hmm. PTSD from that. So, like, hearing her story, like, I had somebody mm-hmm. try to kill me 2 times in my life. And
wow.
I still know that what I went through was not as bad as what she described to me. So,
yeah, for 15 months, that sounds harsh, like, unusually.
It really haunted me. So I wanted just, like, to put the story on paper so that it could, you know, get out there. And initially, I was just kind of circulating it to Antifa people. And then what happened that made me publish it was that he published a book that had me in it.
Ooh.
So, I mean, I knew he was going to publish it, and I was like, well, I'll just publish mine too. And I'll publish it on the same day, because he was going to publish it on the anniversary of the Charlottesville.
Oof.
Which is really fucking offensive. Mm-hmm. He wasn't able to because his publisher dropped him and took me on. So I kind of mm-hmm. won that.
Oh, okay.
So his never got published.
It got published, like, but through this, like, dinky alternative route where there's not color photographs and it has to be in 3 volumes. So it was like a minor victory there. But by the way, something I should mention too is his role in Charlottesville. He authored, like, the official manifesto for Charlottesville.
Oh, yeah. Can you kind of explain what that was about for people who maybe have either never knew or maybe they forgot?
For what the statement was about?
Or just, like, what the whole Charlottesville situation was as well.
So, okay. The Unite the Right rally happened on August 12th, 2017. And it was a sort of coalitional, like, political rally for all types of fascists, which, you know, there are types. and it's supposed to be just conservatives in general, but really it was almost all different forms of white nationalists. It was led by Jason Kessler. Richard Spencer was also involved. But Augustus, he wrote the first draft of the statement that became the Charlottesville statement, and it's on, like, altright.com if you look it up, which I don't recommend.
Yeah, I don't want to poison my mind with that, but yeah.
But, so, yeah, I mean, it was a horrible failure. They did a tiki torch. Well, it wasn't a failure from maybe their perspective, but it ended in extreme violence. Like, they did a tiki torch rally to, you know, in the memory of how the KKK would do torchlit marches mm-hmm. the night before. And then the next day, the actual rally was disrupted because I guess there was a problem with the permits or something. So the police declared it an unlawful assembly, and pretty much all hell broke loose at that point. And mm-hmm. a kid named, I think, James Fields, who is from one of the white nationalist groups, drove over and hit 19 protesters with his car, and another woman named Heather Hare, who was killed. So it was pretty horrible. I didn't sleep, like, that whole week, because, like, I knew someone was going to die just knowing Augustus. Like, like, the first time I met him, I didn't think he was a Nazi, but I immediately knew he was capable of killing somebody. Like, that was my first vibe.
Did you sense that there was something off?
Yeah, it was not really something I could process correctly because I was psychotic. But I knew that he was capable of killing someone. And, like, you know, my boyfriend was at the apartment when he came over. And I was, like, afraid that he was going to come back and kill my boyfriend to, like, steal me away from him for a while. Like, I was just... And it wasn't even anything he said or did that I can point to. But I just got that
vibe. You can just tell.
Yeah. And it's not like I get that vibe all the time from people or something. So.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I got that vibe at all from someone.
Yeah, it's not so viscerally. Anyway, I can get kind of paranoid about, like, people being dangerous, given my PTSD. But it's not, like, such a visceral certainty. It wasn't, like, even a question. And so I knew that someone wasn't going to survive the Charlottesville rallies, and I didn't sleep that whole weekend. And, you know, I kind of felt like, would it have gone differently if Augustus had gotten locked up for, you know, beating somebody and hadn't participated in Charlottesville? Is this, like, my responsibility? Which I know in retrospect, I shouldn't hold myself responsible for that. But it was,
oh, yeah, it's his fault at that point, obviously. Yeah.
It was a serious, like, weight on me for a while to... You know, think about that I've been that close to somebody who was capable of that. And, you know, there's emerging proof that there was a lot of conspiracy to commit violence with that rally. Like, they didn't plan for it to be a peaceful rally. So
it doesn't sound like it was planned to be, from what I've heard. Yeah. So aside from some of the more unsavory, to put it very lightly, aspects of his personal character, can you go ahead and enlighten the audience? I did this the other day when I was talking about the bishop who had groped Ariana Grande. I feel like naming names and pointing out bad behavior like this is important. So can you give the audience just an overview of, first of all, what are his political views and what are some things they should watch out for?
It's a little difficult because he is outside of the box and, like, original in a way, which, you know, being original isn't necessarily a good thing. It can be good or bad, but he's an original thinker in a way. And he doesn't fit into a lot of clear boxes. And it's also hard to tell because he's not an honest person, which I didn't realize until I, you know, learned that he had been allegedly beating his ex.
What are his goals?
So you don't really know what his goals are or what he believes based on what he says. But if I had to, I can try to summarize, like, what I suspect, you know.
Sure.
I mean, I think he wants to be in as much power as an individual as is possible. I've honestly, sometimes I have wondered if he actually believes in fascism or white nationalism at all. Or if he's just completely morally bankrupt and he knows that he can get influence in that sphere.
So you think either he is a fascist white nationalist or he's a sociopath who's taking advantage of those views to further their goals and further his own glory.
Yeah, because there's not really, like, a high bar among, like, fascists. You know, they kind of take what they can get. So you don't have to be, like, that exceptional to kind of get some notoriety, is my sense. In fact, quite the opposite. I think part of what draws people into fascism is that, like, no matter how bad you've been in your life, no matter how bad some things you've done are, fascists aren't going to judge you. Especially if the bad things you've done are violent, because the glorification and aestheticization of violence is built into the philosophy of fascism. So it's actually going to be a sign of your virtue if you've done horrible, violent things, whereas in the rest of society, you would be reviled.
So it's just, it has an element of just naturally attracting the worst of the worst people. And not just in terms of, like, you're bad, but in terms of you've committed heinous crimes against other people and against humanity and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the organization that he represented in court, like, I'm pretty sure they've committed hate crimes and bombings. I don't know if all of those have been even solved, but I just know, based on, like, interacting with him and people around him, and it's pretty extreme. So, But I mean, he wants, another interesting thing about him is that he's got an environmentalist bent, but it's like Ted Kaczynski Unabomber environmentalism. Like, technology is sucking our souls and we need to, like, it's almost like primitivist in a way. Like, we need to be really rugged men because we're all men here, like, in his world. Like, it's a very masculine dominated world, so he's not really interested in the ethics of how a woman should live their life other than to be obedient, but he's very interested in this image of the rugged masculine individual, like, surviving in the wilderness. He does, like, Marines training on his own, and, you know, he, like, what's it called, CrossFit type stuff. He's, like, super into that, just like the ethos of, like, detaching from technology and being a body, which is, like, another bastardized concept of Nietzsche's, because Nietzsche was interested in, you know, opposing Cartesian dualism and, like, the metaphysical explanations of Christianity in favor of a return to the earth and the body. But, like, you know, he probably didn't mean, like, throw away all your technology. So there's that. And that can justify a lot of things, because, like, you know, there are a lot of ways you could solve global warming that would involve, like, killing a lot of people, but it would solve global warming. And, like, you know, just, like, deny people resources and things like that, and just let them face the elements. So there's that kind of problem in his thought, too. But he's also just, like, anti-Semitic and racist.
Why is he anti-Semitic?
That's kind of a mystery to me, because so I was basically, like, raised, but I was raised by these two professors I had, because I started college so young, who were both Jewish, and I would go to their houses for the high holidays, and they taught me a lot about Jewish philosophy and religion. So, like, he knew that about me and how much Judaism has influenced my life. So he didn't talk about that around me. But somebody else contacted me and told me he had said that Jews were not human beings.
Oof.
So I don't understand it, because he wouldn't talk to me about it. So I can't offer a lot of insight.
Would you say that, from your perspective, being close to, like, the inside of fascism, or those people, that they're okay with other members of their group behaving so poorly because they've behaved poorly and they have to sort of stick together or else everybody will be against them, maybe? Or,
yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the only thing I would add is that you have to keep in mind that fascism is a really hierarchical social organization, like, or social philosophy or whatever you want to call it. So, like, there are people who've, like, distinguished themselves by being exceptionally brutal and who are relatively smart and things like that, who are kind of considered to be, like, the leaders. And then there's a lot of people who even conceive of themselves as being, like, the drones, whose job is to just obey these, like, Ubermenches who are, like, running around leading fascism. So I don't know that it's distributed equally among the population of people who identify as fascists. I think some of them might be kind of watching the show, and some of them are more of the ringleaders.
Right. Like, in any type of social situation, really.
Yeah, but just taken to an extreme. And I can't say, you know, you can know for certain that every person who's a fascist is extremely violent, but it's, I'm interested in that. I think if you probably did a study, like, you'd probably find much higher rates of domestic violence among fascists and things like that. So
would you say that among fascists there's typically a worshipping of these people in power who have been violent, like Hitler or Stalin or whomever?
Yeah, it's weird because they don't want to worship Stalin. They're really rabidly anti-communist, so they morally posture like they're really offended by the deaths under Stalin's regime and everything, but they're also minimizing the deaths under Hitler's regime.
So some deaths are okay and other deaths aren't.
It depends on who you're killing, I guess.
Yeah, so these are definitely not all Lives Matter people.
No.
I had a question, by the way. And I'm going to ask the question. I'm going to explain why I'm asking it. Do you think he's an idiot or just a psychopath, because I feel like it doesn't take much effort and research to understand that an ideology like fascism or white nationalism, or really any more of the extreme far right stuff, obviously doesn't have a chance of really taking over America in 2018 for just so many reasons. So he's either a moron or he's insane. So which do you think it is?
So unless I'm a lot stupider than I think I am, I would say I think he's more like psychopathic than stupid. I think that he's more concerned with personal power and the form that he's able to obtain it through being this sort of micro celebrity within the white nationalist movement. And I think he's also interested in the opportunity to personally commit or contribute to violence. That's my subjective evaluation of his character.
Do you think there's any chance that he could come around and get out of that?
No, I don't. I held on to that for a while after I realized he was a fascist, and that's part of what I write about in my book, because, you know, we were pretty close. Like, he came into my life after my father died, and his, like, traditionalism sort of made him a father figure to me. Mm-hmm. He organized an orgy for my birthday, really thoughtful things like that, you know.
Nice of him.
So, yeah, it was really sweet. I lost my train of thought saying that. What were you asking me?
Well, you're talking about how you think that there's no chance for redemption at this point.
So I held on to the hope that that was a possibility, especially because our friendship was pretty intellectual. Like, we would debate things all the time. I never pretended like I agreed with him, even when I thought he was a libertarian. So I was always hoping like I'd find that one thing that would kind of persuade him to change his views. But then I ultimately realized that, like, even if I did persuade him to change his views, he's pretty deep into that shit. Like, there are rumors that he's part of a cult called the Order of Nine Angles, which believes in human sacrifice. He's pretty out there in terms of, like, he's interacted with seedy characters, I'm confident, who have, like, relatively more or less power, you know, not just like some guy off the street, but like, I wouldn't be shocked if there were people in police departments who like him, who are like higher up, because I don't understand why charges aren't being pursued against him. So I don't think he has the option of leaving without threatening his own life.
Okay. Because he's so far in.
Yeah, because I'm sure he knows shit and he knows people. So like, if he tried to leave, there would be people who would come after him and he'd have to deal with that. And I think he's too selfish to put himself through having to deal with that for the sake of, like, doing the right thing.
So this is kind of a broad question, but this is getting more into the theory and the open-ended end of this conversation, where I would ask, what are we supposed to do about people like this? What are we supposed to do about the Augustuses or the Austins, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really hard question. At first, like, when I was fighting the harassment from the Nazis and the lawsuit threat and stuff, I was like, had this moment where I almost wanted to show him some mercy. And I was like, maybe it wouldn't even help for him to go to prison. And I started rationalizing that, like, oh, there are white supremacist gangs in prison, so if he goes to prison, he'll just network with them and get stronger, and he'll be more angry when he gets out, and he probably won't get, like, incarcerated for very long, so maybe he shouldn't go to prison. But at this point, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'm even kind of consider myself to be somewhat of a prison abolitionist in a way. Like, I think that some type of, like, rehabilitation for, you know, violent people and things like that is necessary in society. But I think our current prison system is so corrupt that, like, abolition would be a necessary intermediary step to having any kind of just rehabilitation in a criminal justice system or whatever. So, but for him, I don't know. I mean, it sounds kind of, I'm kind of scared to even say this because I picture him like listening and getting pissed off, but like, I don't care if he goes to jail or not at this point. Like, even though I think prisons are horrible, you know, yeah. I think that it tells a lot. You can tell a lot about our society given that she told the police, "Hey, I'm scared to talk to you because he's threatening to kill me." Then they're like, "Oh, well, we want to pursue charges." And she mysteriously stopped responding to them. And they didn't investigate that any further.
Yeah, that, by the way, that's pretty common. I noticed that there's a lot of people talking right now about, well, why didn't you come forward with these allegations before? And in a lot of cases, they do, but then they get scared once they realize that it could have a consequence. And in a lot of abusive relationships, people think that the threats that they're being given are going to be acted upon, and they don't realize that they will actually have some level of protection, or they don't believe it because they, you know, they're so scared. And so in a lot of cases, people are going forward, if they back out because they're afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I don't have any way of knowing that for certain, but I'm pretty confident that's what happened in this case, because they wanted to pursue charges for something like domestic battery by strangulation and aggravated assault with a firearm or something like that. And mm-hmm. so they tried to contact her again for more information, and she never responded.
Yeah. Well, getting into the topic of prisons, I think that on some level you might need prisons for that kind of person. Like I don't support prisons for white collar criminals. I think I think restitution is much more important for them to pay back what they have stolen, which is usually the case. But when it comes to violent offenders, especially ones that use potentially lethal force, like assault with a gun, those are the kind of people you actually do have to lock up.
Thing, because otherwise everyone's going to start killing each other in the streets to deal with the other guy who's going to kill somebody in the streets. It's like,
And I understand, by the way, knowing what you know about him, why you would feel scared to say, "Well, I don't care if he goes to jail," but I don't feel like people should feel scared of that. I feel like they should feel empowered to say, you know, this person doesn't deserve to roam free after what they've done. So
sometimes when a story gets publicity, or gets covered by like the media, the police are sort of pressured into reopening investigations. Mm-hmm. So I guess on one level, that's part of my goal, is to try to get publicity for the story, because I think it should look really bad for this police department that nothing has been done. Because there's 30 pages of reports from like 5 different people saying he threatened them with a gun.
There's actually a case, which I think it's a different case that happened to get solved very recently. And I think it's kind of relevant here, which is that, do you know who the Golden State Killer is?
Yeah. I kind of related to that story too already. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Did you know that he actually got caught?
Uh-huh.
From 1974 to 1986, there was someone named the Golden State Killer. And there was also someone named the Original Night Soccer and the East Area Rapist. It all turned out to be the same guy. Basically, this guy was a serial killer, a serial rapist, and a burglar. And they had absolutely no idea who he was. And so the case went cold. But people kept giving attention to the case. And what's that guy's name? It's like that famous comedian, Patton Oswalt. His wife at the time did a book on him and re-inspired kind of public interest in it. And that may have motivated the police to look at other leads, like, because they're thinking, maybe there's something we can do now. And so they ended up tracing some of his DNA on some of those ancestry kind of websites where they test your family members and stuff. And they actually caught him in 2018. So it's never too late. Like, it's never too late to, you know, drum up some interest in some stuff that never really got resolved.
Yeah, I totally related to that story when I read about it, because I remember they said something about how she was sort of consumed by the story. Mm-hmm. And I relate to that feeling, because it's like, I get, I mean, I get sick of talking about it sometimes, but because it's so outrageous and it was so I was so personally like close to the events that it's like, well, if I'm going to be obsessing about this anyway, I may as well try to like make something productive out of all of that energy. And like, if I can change something, then.
Lastly on that, I just wanted to point out, I don't want to just name her as Patton Oswalt's wife. I'd like to actually say her name is Michelle McNamara. And if you guys want to look her up, I recommend you look into that story. I also recommend to the audience, you look up the Golden State Killer. Very interesting story, especially
the
resolution.
Didn't he end up being a police chief or something?
Yeah, there's speculation that that's how he got away with it, is he worked for the police. So it's like, and in some cases, he was involved on the teams that were investigating him.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of
heard about that.
Yeah. He's doing kind of a Dexter thing. It was.
That's crazy.
Really insane. Like, it's brilliant, but it's nuts. Like, it's one of the worst people in Southern California, and had some really tricky ways to get away with it.
Well, the good news, and there is some good news in terms of accountability for Augustus so far, which is that when these allegations came out. And then, especially after his role in Charlottesville, he lost all of his political funding. People didn't want to be associated with him, and he became unhirable as a lawyer. So he dropped out of the race for Senate, and his second run for Senate. And he basically is like living in the woods in South Carolina with a woman who has also accused him of violence to the police, to whom he's now married. And he's just like publishing books, which in the grand scheme of things, like, I think there are more damaging things he could be doing with his time than publishing books. So I'm kind of like glad about the outcome in that regard, even if it still seems insufficient.
It's not sufficient, but it's something, I guess, in that he kind of had to not go into exile, but he had to retreat from
into exile. He totally dropped off all social media and went off the grid for a long time at first.
In related note, the Golden State Killer, basically people who knew him, they had no idea. And I think it would be difficult for me to blame you for, you know, getting involved with someone if you don't really know their character, because if someone can hide being the Golden State Killer, then I think they can hide some of their more objectionable political views from someone, especially when there's, you know, friendly / sexual / romantic interest to some extent. You know, it's that's pretty common. So I have seen no reason to be convinced that you are sympathetic towards that at all.
I appreciate that.
I think, yeah. So is there anything about your story that you haven't really gotten an opportunity to talk about that you wanted to go over before we kind of close things up? Or
I guess it's kind of related to what you just said. The one thing I can think of, which is that, like I said, I was obsessed with the situation, and he's tried to play it as like, I'm obsessed with him romantically, and that's why I do this. He's tried all different ways to invalidate everything I say. And that's one of them. But the point that I'm trying to make is that I knew he was dangerous from the get-go, even if I didn't know he was a fascist. But at first, that was almost something I perceived as a good thing, because I thought he was good-willed towards me. So I have like had stalkers and stuff in my life, and I felt safe around him as a result of that, because I knew like my stalkers wouldn't mess with me if I was associating with him and things like that. But at the same time, then that kind of turned around on me, because once he got upset at me, I was still invested in his approval, even when I didn't want to be, because his approval meant my safety. But that was because he was the one who could hurt me. So that kind of kept me trapped in the situation, like psychologically, for a while. And I think maybe that is what a lot of people didn't understand, that maybe led to suspicion about my motives or something.
So it was ultimately fear at the end of it.
Yeah, by the end, I mean, I was afraid, but I was still like, sometimes I would like drunk text him
mm-hmm.
and like tell him I loved him or apologize or something like that. Because I was trying to get his approval because I felt safer if I knew I had his approval.
But the other side of that coin is if he turned on you, then...
Exactly. It's very insidious. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe, did you have any last-minute questions on this topic specifically? Or
well, there's one question or just so, like an observation kind of that could be made about people in the fascist community. You know, you used to have people in the KKK wearing hoods and they were anonymous. And now you've got people who are appearing in these rallies and you could see their faces and people are losing their jobs because of it. Rightfully so, I assume, in many cases. These are people who are very hateful and, you know, employers don't want to have them employed.
It's PR liability at the minimum, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. What do you make of that, Alexandria? Like, these people that are, I guess, not afraid of showing their identity, or is it that they're already considering themselves like an underdog and they don't care if people know who they are because they couldn't go lower or something like that? Or like
I do think the underdog thing is at play sometimes, but I don't even think it's conscious. I guess what we have to confront is that America is an experiment in democracy, right? And there are valuable things about the U.S. Constitution and everything, but nonetheless, like, it was founded in a historical context that was like a form of white supremacy, and founding fathers were slave owners. So there's mm-hmm. sort of contradiction yeah. at the heart of like the way this country is structured, where they're trying to grant equality to all people, but it's happening in a social context where these people weren't really fully ready to embrace the repercussions of what they were saying and live according to their values. So there's a way in which it's not, I mean, that's how Trump happened, in my opinion, is it's like, there's a way in which it's not outside the mainstream to be a white supremacist. Like, there's a low-key white supremacist in lots of people who don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's really important, I think, for people to realize, because like a lot of people think, oh, well, if Augustus is so bad, like it must have been obvious to you that he was evil. And so you must have willingly gone into that situation. They don't want to admit that like you can be, like I said, like a low-key white supremacist and still mm-hmm. be like an apparently decent person or normal person in other ways. Like it's yeah. actually more, it's not like a, like the alt-right is a recent phenomenon, but white supremacy in the US mm-hmm. is not. Is what I would say.
So we've kind of conducted this episode so far on the assumption that people who tend to listen to it are going to be relatively on our wavelength, and we've kind of taken it as a given that the kinds of attitudes that fascism and white nationalism and the alt-right exude are detestable, but we haven't really said it. So I don't think people, because the people who have been listening to us for the last few months are very familiar with the host's political views, but they probably aren't so familiar with yours. So can you kind of explain how you feel about all this? Like, where do you land politically, and how do you feel about some of the stuff that people like Augustus are spewing?
I think there are certain things Augustus has said to me that I can find some kernel of merit in. Whether or not he means what he says, I don't know, but his he does critique like the police state and the sort of overbearing role that the state has in people's lives in a way that I think can be valuable. But that's sort of the problem is that there are little tiny kernels of truth in what he says in the overarching context of something that's pretty detestable. And I think that, you know, I collect disability, and he thinks that should not be the case. Like, I should just not be able to collect disability. And if I didn't have it, you know, I don't know what would happen to me. So it's a pretty terrible thing. I'm politically kind of homeless, especially after what I've been through, honestly, because I have a hard time believing that a really like well-governed democracy could exist on the scale that would be required for the United States to function.
Oh yeah, that's a topic for a whole another day. Yeah, I could go into that.
A lot of my views about politics got informed by the unique environment of the school where I did my undergraduate work, and like that was sort of like a direct democracy. Like the administration would let the students change stuff about the administration, or you know, do stuff like that, and we would have town hall meetings, and like everyone from the school would participate, and so that. I saw how well that worked, and I guess I like that idea, and it's kind of almost like the anarchist direct democracy kind of ideas. But then at the same time, I recognize that there's a difficulty with implementation there, because anytime like a direct democracy that doesn't rely on the rule of the state or electoral politics would come into being, it would be suppressed by the state, and anarchists don't have like a historical record of being really successful in resisting in those types of situations. So I'm not optimistic about like a stateless world or something like that. And I don't support authoritarian communism. I have a lot of problems with that. I knew a Stalinist who was really active locally in like leftist activism, and that was really disturbing to me. We argued all the time about like Mao versus Hannah Arendt in terms of philosophy of violence and stuff like that. So I don't know where I land, because I want to say I'm like on the left with libertarian leanings, but at this point I'm too disturbed by the way that there's fascist entryism into libertarianism to even really want to use that word.
My take on what a lot of people sort of like mean when they say like, oh, I'm a libertarian, is they want to get away. I mean, they want to do away with a lot of social programs that offer a lot of benefits. Like, I had a coworker who said he's a libertarian, and I said, what do you mean by that? And he says, no regulations. So I said, so we shouldn't regulate the lead levels in like paint, and like we shouldn't regulate the toxicity of water. And he's like, well, some regulation. And I was like, all right. And I was like, I feel like that in that moment that he said some regulation, I was like, all right, we could go on forever where he just outlines the regulations he does want. So really what he wants to do is get away, is do away with certain regulations. And I would agree that certain regulations could probably go away.
That's true. But I mean, the problem with regulations is that they tend to heap up over time. And it's kind of like that idea where when you go to the pool and you see it, you see on the sign, it says like, you know, don't pee in the pool or don't run while you're around the pool. They're there because some idiot probably named like Keith or something did those things. And now they have to have a rule for it. So that's actually motivating a lot of this. And I think it's possible that we could go back and reevaluate some of those later and say, you know, some people were doing this, but maybe it's not really a thing anymore. We can move back a little bit.
But if it's not really a thing anymore, maybe just leave it because it was a good rule then. And if you get rid of it, maybe it'll become a thing again.
Yeah, I think, well, I think it's kind of a case-by-case basis. It really depends, yeah.
It has to be a case-by-case basis, because if the defunct law is like now still being enforced, but in like a perverted way, then maybe you shouldn't just leave it.
Would you call yourself an anti-fascist?
Yeah, I recently put that on my social media because I was tired of like pretending otherwise, I guess. I really felt like I had to be quiet about that for a while because Augustus says things like every Antifa should be shot on sight and things like that. So in the immediate aftermath, I published this thing on my blog, which I should probably go look at and decide if I want to keep it on my blog or not. But I published this thing about like how we have to respect everybody's human rights, and white nationalists have certain rights up to the point where they're like actively committing genocide. And I was partially, I think there's some conversation to be had there about that, but I was also just scared. Like, I do support Antifa deplatforming fascists. There's a quote from an article I read yesterday that I did want to share with you guys, which is, there are some stupid mistakes that only very smart people make, and one of them is the notion that a sensible argument seriously presented can compete with a really good piece of theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard that the other day. That's a great quote.
Theater, right? They're not going into it with a commitment to truth or traditional meaning or reasonable debates. They're there under the guise of free speech to incite violence. And that's already been demonstrated to us through Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. So, like, in terms of public debates and things like that, I, especially given, you know, Antifa has not killed anybody, you know? So, like, when people talk about Antifa being violent, I think it's really overstated. And I also think, like, even if there's this one rogue guy who hits somebody with a baseball bat, like, it's, like, difficult to say that, therefore, the entire project of trying to resist fascism is a bad idea. So,
well, it's difficult if you're intellectually honest, but it's very easy for certain conservative people to just suggest that immediately. The moment one person does one thing in one situation, the whole thing's apparently violent. So,
yeah, actually, Augustus published an article about me kind of recently, because I'm speaking at his alma mater on October 3rd on a discussion panel on white nationalism. And he somehow, like, found out about emails professors at that school were sending to each other about my discussion panel. I have no idea how he found out about those emails. It's really creepy. But he published the picture of one of the professors who was supporting me in this article he wrote about me, and, like, was excoriating the professor. And he also called me a member of the criminal gang Antifa, who is his sworn personal and political enemy. So I kind of put that on a business card.
Yeah, that's great. By the way, just side note, did you read that quote on an article called No, I Will Not Debate You? Yeah, that was a good one. I'll put a link to that in the description. Great article. It's a long read. It's from longreads.com. So you know it's going to be a long one, but it's a great one to take a half hour, you know, plunge into it. It kind of goes into why, in particular, formal debate, I think, is kind of a waste of time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in a weird position because I interviewed Augustus, and I even interviewed him when I suspected he was a fascist, and I've still got that on my blog. But that was kind of for my own understanding. I wasn't trying to, like, I wasn't necessarily trying to convert people to one or the other opinion during those interviews. I just kind of decided to share them because I might as well if I was doing them. I think that public debates that are, you know, intended to sway people's political opinions are a totally different animal.
One quick final question, like, well, final serious question is, knowing just what you know about this person and having experienced a psychologically complicated relationship / friendship with him, what are some of the warning signs that someone can look out for when it comes to this kind of person? Like, how do you know that something might be lurking?
Well, there are red flags that I can perceive in retrospect. So, first of all, the fact that my first impression of him was that he was capable of murder is something I shouldn't have romanticized as keeping me safe because he would kill my enemies or whatever. But also, I like interacted a bit with his ex-fiance and him at the same time. Like, you know, we all rented a beach house for my birthday, as I mentioned, and we hung out some other times as well. And there were, like, red flags there. He was extremely controlling at the beach house. He took away our phones. It was it was him and three girls, and he took away our phones. And I had wanted a male friend to come over early in the evening to hang out with us. And, like, he got the phone from me and talked to this guy on the phone and told him he couldn't come. And he tried to, like, make it sexy. He was like, yeah, I'm a territorial panther. But he was also doing knife play with Victoria at that party. And that was, like, I don't know, it's BDSM and I'm a dominatrix. So, like, I didn't think, oh, he must be beating her. But like in retrospect, knife play is something that's like, you know, probably.
Well, it's a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, in some cases. So there, and that's for the domestic violence part of it, really, which we should view as, you know, related to white nationalism. But as far as the red flag for someone being a white nationalist, I mean, I don't.
Oh, yeah. Are there any good, like, code words or, like, attitudes that should raise a.
Can we, let's like, tell people to look at my blog.
Okay.
AlexandriaBrown.tumblr.com. So the first interview with him is sort of case study in that without realizing it, because I didn't think he was a fascist, but like I perpetuated all these dog whistles in it. I have a disclaimer on the interview now saying this guy's a fascist, but the interview is like, he just really cares about European people and you know, things like that. So there, so if you look at that first interview I did with him, which is the first post on that blog, you can kind of see the white supremacy between the cracks there, I think.
Okay.
He didn't like the Federal Reserve. I don't know if that's a red flag.
it could be a piece of the puzzle. It could just be someone who doesn't like the Fed, but yeah, it could be. So, okay. So yeah, people should check out, especially if they want to find out more about you or more about your time with him or more about how you got out of that. They can head over to your blog.
My book's on Amazon, too. It's
The Noble Person Does Not Sin.
Yeah. I explain what the title means in the beginning of the book. Don't worry.
Okay. Joe, you got any last thoughts or anything? Or?
No, not really.
You okay, I mean, there, buddy?
Yeah, no, I was thinking. I was doing my thinking noise.
Okay. Yeah. Believe it or not, by the way, Alexandria, this podcast is usually really goofy. Like this
I
is
saw
a
that.
Really,
yeah, really I saw wacky. That.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we tone it way down when we're interviewing guests because we want to give them a space to, you know, move about and not worry about us being kind of dorky. But
on our own, it's much more directorial commentary that we have to edit out. Like we'll say something and we'll be like, "Ooh, let's do the rewind gag right there."
Yeah, that's we have gags like that or
lots of gags.
Yeah, we have like this fake. We have a fake other host who like is really like inappropriate and racist, and we always like chide him and stuff for saying stuff. We don't like him. We kick him off a lot. But you know,
I think that's a red flag.
Yeah, red flag is if he's racist. He might be a white nationalist at that point. Yeah. So okay, let's cap this off with something a little bit more lighthearted. I have a $2 billion question for you, which is. For $2 billion, would you spend the next 4,300 years as a duck?
Do I get more years of life after that?
You immediately become a duck, and then if you die, you become another duck. And then, so for the next 4,300 years, you'll just be a duck.
But when the 4,300 years are over, my life isn't over, right?
You go right back to where you are right now.
Oh.
And you'll have all the duck knowledge.
Absolutely.
The duck knowledge.
I've wanted duck knowledge for a while.
wisdom.
I was thinking about that because, like,
you were thinking about becoming a duck.
No, I was thinking
years
about
to have the duck knowledge,
like oblivion versus eternity. Would I rather like just have oblivion, or would I rather live but in eternal suffering? And I think I would choose eternal suffering because, like, it's at least like interesting.
Okay. I would personally prefer Skyrim over Oblivion. What do you think, Joe?
Okay.
I played a lot of Elder Scrolls, and it kept me entertained. I could play that for $2 billion. Was that the question? If I would play Elder Scrolls for $2 billion?
No.
For 4,300 years.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'd play. Yeah, hey, would you play that game for 4,300 years? Because that's actually an interesting question.
Me?
No, Joe.
Oh.
Me? Like... Can I take water breaks and stuff? Or?
Yeah, but I feel like it would drive you nuts.
Well, I would try to get 100%.
Could you
I feel like after 100 years, like I'd get 100%.
And spend the next 4,400 years in eternal suffering.
Eternal boredom. Yeah.
Yeah. One more question, okay. Which is, what would you do if right now someone showed up at your door and said, we have 20,000 tons of Nutella and we're just going to leave it with you. What would you do with it?
What would I do with it?
That's 40 million pounds, by the way.
Well,
20,000 tons.
You can try to lift it, but you won't be able to.
Try to refrigerate it somehow or something. Does Nutella go bad? I don't know.
Maybe after.
I guess what I would do is looking for those Biscoff cookies.
Ah.
20,000 pounds of Biscoff cookies.
The Nutella. Yeah. Everyone else was like, well, I'll probably try to sell it.
I'd have to change my shtick as a dominatrix. So I'd have to become the morbidly obese. I'm sorry.
Or just become the... Become the dominatrix that also gives you a complimentary jar
that force feeds you Nutella or something really creepy like that. Yeah, mm-hmm.
You could surprise them with the Nutella. You could put a blindfold on them and then put their hand into Nutella and
that's
be like,
"True, that'd be a great idea."
Yeah. Speaking of all that, by the way, there's enough material that we barely even touched on in regards to a variety of topics, which I think would make another good 18 episodes. But for now, I think, we're pushing at least an hour.
Okay.
I think, Joe, you want to sign us off?
Thanks for joining us today. My name's Joe, and I've been one of the co-hosts, and here's Lars, the other co-host. And joining us today is Alexandria Brown.
I can speak for myself, dude. Yeah,
you said
my name
sign
is...
us off.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're doing that very literally. My name is Lars, and... I'm the main host and editor of the first podcast, and with us today was Alexandria Brown.
She can sign herself off.
Yeah,
Lars.
She can.
The author of a memoir about exposing criminal allegations against one of the organizers of Charlottesville.
I think this was a good one, and we'll see you next time.
See you later.
Bye.
Thanks for joining in.
See you on MySpace.